I'm really pleased to welcome Tim Willens to our studio today for the Screenside Chats. Tim is the ACAP Distinguished Fellow and Chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Mass General Hospital, where he also holds the academic title of Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's also an MGH trusted endowed chair in addiction medicine and co-director of the Center of Addiction Medicine at Mass General Hospital. Among his contributions to ACAP, which are many, he's a past member of the program and new research subcommittees. I didn't know you were off of that, Tim. As well as currently involved in the research committee and the psychopharmacology and neurotherapeutics committee and the NIDA ACAP K-12 executive committee. He's certainly well known for his substance abuse contributions, but we're talking to him today about his other area of expertise, which is clinical psychopharmacology, and he's done research in that for over 20 years. He's been interested in the short and long-term outcomes of ADHD, substance use, and bipolar disorder treated with medication. He's here today to discuss some contemporary thinking about virtual visits during this COVID pandemic, and we will pick his brain about how he's changed, if he has changed, what he does psychopharmacologically, both in terms of the assessment and management of the kids. He and Adelaide Robb are co-chairs of the Psychopharmacology and Neurotherapeutics Committee, and it was when I was kibitzing on their meeting a few weeks ago and they were talking about some of the things that they were doing that I said this would be a really nice topic for Screenside Chats because so many of us do psychopharmacologic treatment that I think the insights from that committee would be very helpful. So thank you for being here, Tim. The first question is, what kinds of problems are you finding kids presenting to your psychopharmacology clinic at this point, with the school being online and people can't come in and have visits with you? What kinds of problems are you seeing?
Well, first of all, thanks so much, Gabe, for having me on. And I did want to comment that before I start that the views I'm talking about are certainly somewhat parochial to sort of what we're doing in the Boston area. But I also want to say I generalize it because we've had conversations within the pediatric psychopharm and neurotherapeutics committee. And a number of the things I'm saying are also endorsed by the committee. So these are, in my opinion, some of the things we're gonna talk about are sort of the morphed standard of care that has emerged. And I think that's actually really important for people to appreciate because you may be practicing in isolation and saying, geez, what am I doing? And is this a reasonable and can I do that? So I just wanted to say that right out of the gates that this, many of the things I'm going to say, and I'll try to expressively say that, has really been endorsed by the Psychopharm Committee, which is really an international committee. But to start with what we saw, I have to say initially out of the gates, we expected all heck to occur. We expected everything to fall apart. And we didn't see that. And a lot of people were really pretty surprised. We expected a lot of kids who had, let's say, autism spectrum, who were in these very structured settings, who came home to immediately decompensate. So the good news was, for at least the first month of the COVID restrictions and stay-at-home orders, most people around the country were finding actually less issues. And you think about it, it makes sense. Many of our kids suffer from school phobias, anxiety around school, you know, all of these issues. And that seemed to really be reduced. Of course, the flip side of that is a lot of those anxiety disorders are going to be exacerbated when we return back. Exactly. So that was the good news. What seems to be emerging over the last 1 to 2 weeks, so the honeymoon is over, we're seeing a lot more mood dysregulation. We're seeing mood reactivity. We're seeing a lot more family conflicts that are playing out. We're seeing kids whose
honeymoon is over. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And we're seeing kids like with ADHD where their behaviors were more tolerated, less tolerated. And now that academics had settled down for high school students, et cetera, we're seeing in middle schoolers and elementary schoolers, and expectations are back up. We're seeing parents who are monitoring these kids carefully and seeing real problems and saying, you know, look, things just aren't working. Whereas they may have looked like they were working, they're not working now. And the last group that I don't want to forget is college students. They're home and there's a lot more depression, hopelessness, and helplessness. a vast, vast majority of them had jobs canceled, internships canceled. They're home with their families. They're separated from their peers. So we're seeing a lot more depression and some sort of anxiety, but in a different type of anxiety in these kids.
So the bloom is off the rose. How has telehealth changed how you're conducting the office visits that you're having with the kids? And again, I like the way that you included children, adolescents, and transitional age youth. How has telehealth changed what you do?
Yeah, so everything is now through telehealth, and people are having to adapt very quickly. And, you know, we always look at the practitioner side of things and having to adapt. But I want to remind people that there are a lot of people on the other side of us, parents and grandparents who take care of kids who are not used to using telehealth, who are getting used to it. About half of our telehealth is occurring through video conference, and a lot of the technology has improved in front of our eyes to make things work in these embedded major electronic health records. And there are a lot of answering systems you can use, but at least half are happening by phone because certain people are just not comfortable with the video conferencing. So that's sort of technically what's happening. We are trying to utilize, and I think you can, HIPAA-approved systems, although there's been some relaxation, allowing you to use any video systems that are necessary to be able to make things work. I'll come back to this, but I think telehealth has changed, first of all, things from management of kids. You may want to get in-person, you know, vital signs. You're not going to do that. And then it's, you know, how do you manage the kids pharmacologically when you're talking about the different medicines in terms of monitoring and things like that? So we're not being able to say, okay, we're thinking of starting this medicine and we'd like to get baseline EKG or baseline laboratories. We're not doing that. You're on a medicine and typical guidelines may say to do this or that, and we're not doing that. So, yeah,
so we can come back to that, because that's the way I've sort of divided this up is the evaluation part and then the monitoring and the guidelines and so forth. But just to talk about the initial assessment part, one of the things that I found, well, if you know the patient, then you're almost doing a home visit. It's not like you're trying to break new ground particularly, and that's okay. I know I personally just basically do intakes, the evaluations for schools. And so these are cold calls. These are complete strangers. And it really takes, I think, a lot of work to get that relationship, because they don't know you, you don't know them. You're on the same wavelength because you're both sort of struggling with this monitoring business.
Right.
But people are crying in the background and the dogs are barking and, you know, the husband gets up and he's, you know, not got his shirt on yet and he's wandering out and getting a glass of juice. And I'm not sure how informative some of that information is. And you're in their home. I mean, you are in their home. And so one of the things that I've said to them at the end of the interview is, thank you for inviting me into your home, because that is where I am.
That's exactly right. And I think in some ways, you're in some ways doing what social work has done for years, which is you're almost doing a home visit and you're doing a virtual visit at the same time. You've also got the people where you may be using this. That may be the only mechanism you're using and doing an initial eval. I saw somebody yesterday, for example, who did not want to use video conferencing. We tried, didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. And so now I have a patient that I've never seen and talked to the parents. I don't know what they look like. And yet I've done an entire intake on them and I'm going to be following them. And I hope they go to video so I know what they look like. Mm-hmm. What I'm thinking of is when I go to the waiting room, when we return to normal, I'm going to go out there and not know who they are. It'll be the first time I actually meet with them. And they have this whole fantasy what I look like. So I think that's really different. I think we're learning how to make relationships virtually. And you know what? What's interesting? You can make relationships virtually. It's different, but you can make it. The other area that I think we're doing more from a psychopharmacologic standpoint is we're trying to jump in faster now. We don't want kids languishing out there. So we're doing quicker, faster appointments because we don't want people out in the community without resources we're seeing, we're worried about it. And the other thing is we've set up more virtual care teams. We're hearing about, for example, intensive outpatient programs and partial programs and, you know, these kind of programs that are now entirely virtual, and they seem to be working. You know, we don't have all the data back, but they seem to be working, and they're linked to the psychopharm, so we can transition people into these modes. So there's an opportunity, but it is clearly different. It is clearly different.
When you have to do the psychoeducation, I mean, I think one of the important psychological parts of medication management is the psychoeducational piece. Do you find it's any different doing it this way, or are you having any more or less trouble getting people to buy into starting medication and being monitored?
You know, that's a very interesting question. And what myself and others have noticed with that is people seem to be less obsessive about the all the side effects and the risk benefits of the medication. It's more casual, and that could be good or bad. I had one patient recently where I found it very helpful. I happened to have a slide that I had that I could actually share on some of the issues we were talking about. Mm-hmm. So not everybody has it, but you can actually have resources that you typically use or side effect profiles that you have that I wouldn't necessarily show people in person, but I can just share the screen if we're using Zoom or a similar platform, and then they can see it and we can actually talk through it, and then I reverse that. So in some ways, I love that type of usefulness to do that type of thing. But I do think it feels more casual, and the boundaries feel different. And I try to keep that, you know, try to keep mindful of that.
Is the adherence any different? Again, the kids that I end up seeing that are referred by the school for our particular evaluation clinic I'm not going to call them treatment refractory group, but they're kids that haven't done what they're supposed to do. And so the schools bring in the big guns, you know, go to Stony Brook, see Dr. Carlson, maybe she'll sell you a used car. So that's part of my job. And so I'm dealing with resistance to medication, resistance to treatment, you know, resistance to diagnosis and so forth. And I don't do a bad job getting people listening to why they're being resistant. So it's sort of a motivational interviewing mm-hmm. approach, which is, you know, tell me what your experience has been, what makes you anxious about it, so forth and so on. So I'm that bonding part is important. The props, though, and again, maybe I'm delusional, but the prop of being in the professor's office and, you know, all the diplomas are on the walls and, you know, all the books are around and so forth, it gives you a magna that sitting in my office with my cockeyed lampshade over there doesn't quite give me. Now, maybe that makes me more human, and maybe that's got some advantages to it. But I was just curious about whether your adherence or, you know, people actually doing it after you recommend it has changed.
So in terms of adherence, if I could actually back just a little bit to adherence, which is first the show rates, how many people are actually showing, you know, via virtual visits for, let's say, as opposed to in-person visits, we're finding that our no-show rates have plummeted to almost zero. We have almost no no-shows using virtual visits, whereas, you know, most clinics run about 15 to 20% no-show rates. That's pretty typical. And if you're in a high-risk clinic, maybe up to 30%. Mm-hmm. We have almost no no-show rates. So the first thing I think is important for all kinds of treatment is retention and treatment and coming to treatment. And so virtual visits win big time, and we are really impressed with that. And we're not seeing that extinguish over time. We thought maybe initially out of the gates we'd see it. But so that's actually a very positive thing for PsychoPharm, where people are actually being seen, and we're finding people are making the frequency more frequent, which is probably better because it's easier for the patient and us. Mm-hmm. In terms of adherence, you know, that's yet to be seen. I absolutely agree with you. It's when you're coming into a major, an office, or you're seeing your practitioner in person, the child psychiatrist is sitting across from you in your office. They often have, as you said, props, but they have them in a different way. I would balance that against sort of the reaching out, sort of the casualness and the way people really are communicating and talking, because they're talking virtually. And in some ways, there's this connectedness that I'm not sure we've quantified yet that I certainly feel with our psychopharm visits. And I think part of it is they haven't just driven, in our case, driven into Boston in traffic, found a parking spot, gotten on busy elevators, come up, and there's not the stress around that. And they let their hair down a little bit. Having said that, another thing I'm finding, and we've talked about it as our division, and I've heard around the country, a lot of times when people come in for their visits, it's sometimes the only time the parent and the kid actually talk about what ails the kid. So if the kid is coming in for, let's say, anxiety, they may not really be talking to the kid about anxiety, but when they're coming in to see their child and adolescent psychiatrist, they often will say, you know, let's talk about it. What are you going to say to the doc? What do you think the problem is? And that doesn't happen. So there's a lot more on the fly, I'm finding, that mm-hmm. they're less prepared. And you know, that's got both good and bad. Mm-hmm. I actually always encourage people to use the time that they drive in and leave in a positive way to interact with their kid one-on-one.
I do the same. I mean, the first the kid's heard of is, well, I have to go wake him up and tell him you're on the screen. So you mentioned mood dysregulation. As you know, that's one of my presidential initiative. How are you managing that virtually? Are you getting to see the meltdowns in vivo? How are you managing those?
Well, I think that's actually a really important one. And I certainly laud that being the presidential initiative, because that is one of the major issues that we deal with in day-to-day management, certainly psychopharmacologically, and I think everybody. So I think you got two sides to it. We have a dilemma. We want to lean in, and one of the directives that the Psychopharm Committee absolutely endorsed, uniformly, as well as our own divisions and colleagues of mine in the area, is that you got to have to really lean in and take care of kids, and you got to jump in faster than you would otherwise. You can't afford to have a kid have a major outburst or get to a behavior that then may lead them to a hospitalization via an emergency room. You just don't want them to go into the emergency room, and you really want to try to avoid hospitalizations. So you're in this, you're sort of feeling obligated to step in faster with treatments. And by the way, it's not just medication. We're working very closely with our behaviorists. We actually have agreements that we're going to jump in on their cases, and they're going to jump in on ours, and we're going to do it virtually. And it's, by the way, working really well, and it's what we should have been doing all along. But it seems to work virtually a little bit easier for whatever reason. But let's take a case where it's just going to be med management that we're going to do. So great, we're going to jump in faster. We're going to think about using a second-generation antipsychotic. We may even start a mood stabilizer. We may, if we see an anxiety component, jump in and start using a benzodiazepine or buspirone or something like that. We have to balance that, on the other hand, against, okay, we're going to start these meds or ratchet them up, but how are you going to monitor them? I mean, you're not going to take the kid in. You're not going to want them to come in for blood draws right now. You're not going to want them to come in for an EKG. So I think we're balancing that right now. I would say, on average, most people are seeing the balance more to the direction of increasing the dosage of the medicines or starting medicines that you may have been thinking about, or maybe I will, well, maybe you do it. So instead mm-hmm. of I'm going to, you know, maybe in the next visit or the visit after, you start it. Mm-hmm. And the side about side effects, which we can talk about, and monitoring that type of thing, I think that's taken a back drawer to this right now. But I think that's where the balance has been. And that's definitely what the psychopharmacology committee has thought also, that this really needs to be the way we think during these times.
And as you were implying, as the bloom becomes progressively off the rose and parents are not having fun, are you finding them buying into treatment more readily? I mean, you're there, and sometimes you can see the child getting agitated and so forth, and the parent goes, yeah, this is what I mean, and so forth. Are you finding that you get a little bit less resistance at that part? Because I think there's several reasons why we delay or you know, we wait before we jump in with a medication treatment. Mm-hmm. We want to be thorough about what our evaluation is. We want to see if there are other less I don't know what you want to call it, complicated interventions that might be effective. I'm not necessarily doing that because that's what I want. That's what the parents are telling me. Medication is the last resort. You know, can't we try prayer and fasting before we try, you know, medication? And I say, yeah, but you just told me that your kid took a shovel to the cat. I mean, so, you know, it isn't always the anxiety on our part. It's the families that have been basically saying, oh, dear, you know, this is the last thing I'd ever want to do to my child. So what are you finding with that?
Now, we, you know, this is more personal observation. We haven't really talked as much about that, but I find a few things. And I absolutely agree with you around the families that are much more engaged now in the treatment in some ways. And part of that is, they're not relying on school, which is where kids live, to give them information. They're seeing it firsthand. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting a lot more, immediate report from the parents, very detailed about what's wrong. And they're getting that, no, things aren't going so well. They really understand, and they have more of a three-dimensional understanding of the child's behavior, mm-hmm. which is really helpful to me because as a practitioner, I can steer it a lot more precisely. I also think another thing that's helped with, yes, it's time to do this or with medication, is both parents, if there are two parents in the family or other caregivers in the family, or if the grandparents are still living with the families, there are oftentimes splits between parents or other family members or the school and the parent. Really gets played out in terms of a lot of reluctance and reticence to start medicines or to increase doses. And that is virtually gone. You see a lot more agreement between, you know, individuals at home, caregivers, parents, who are just saying, you know, look, we're both seeing this. This needs to happen. So I see in general people much more favorable about using medicines, starting new medicines, increasing doses of medicine. You know, yesterday I was in clinic. I had a full virtual clinic back to back with a couple new avails on top of that. And I was struck that in almost every case, people were asking for dose increases, in talking about what issues there were. And they were very supportive of, we need to have more of a psychopharmacologic frame about this at that. I also was struck that the parents were kind of much more engaged in what is this medicine doing? What is that medicine doing? We always review that in general psychopharm, but they seem to be much more feeling like on the ground, really seeing this and really wanting to look at the specific clusters of behaviors that may be arise. So again, in some ways, a bit of a silver lining on this one, that you're seeing this, you know, this unity in terms of what to do. But I think in general, you're seeing more use of medicines. And I think it's both because the behaviors are more dysregulated, especially the last couple of weeks. But I also think it's because parents are seeing it and uniform on it.
You know, I had an experience with my last eval. It kind of goes along with what you're saying. I was interviewing the mom. She's a single parent, lives with her father and so kids' grandparents. And I saw lurking going on in the background. And so I said to the mom, why don't you invite your dad to come listen to this? I'm happy to have him hear what I have to say. And I bet he's got some things he can say too. So I said, Grandpa, you know, could you come over? I'd really like to have you be part of this. So Grandpa came over and, you know, he was a little bit shy and so forth. But anyway, we had a nice discussion and he talked about what his concerns were. And so it wasn't a matter of he's not going to be able to take off work to come in and listen to the whole thing. We had him nailed there. And so that was a really important intervention. Okay, I want to move along here. I know when I was kibitzing on your committee, you wanted to talk about the regulatory changes that had taken place. So let's talk about those.
So there's been relaxation in a number of the regulatory oversight, and I think most of us have gotten so used to regulation and oversight, we forgot what it was like. And so it's really been, in some ways, freeing and really opens up the capacity to do telehealth. And there's some real positive movement. For example, the Drug Enforcement Administration is very clearly, and to their credit, openly described and discussed the ideas of controlled substances being allowable through virtual visits by phone or video across state lines, et cetera. And that's been a real positive. And I think that's wonderful. And I hope we can have discussions with them moving forward. So from a regulatory standpoint, controlled substances, you're able to start them now with virtual visits. Cross state lines is allowable. Where there's still a lot of sort of idiosyncratic laws that have not been extraordinarily well worked out is, and you have to be careful, is licensing. So within your state, you have, you know, each person is licensed through their state. Some states have reciprocity. So for example, New England states, there's states in the mid-Atlantic, there's some in the Northwest that have reciprocity. And you have to know that for each of the states. That is, can you see patients? The big issue is, in state, there's usually no problems using virtual visits, but if you're out of state, and can you do that? Will that state allow you to do a new visit, let's say virtually, if you've never seen the patient and you're in a state that's two or three states away? They may not have agreements and that may not be allowable. And why that's important is you don't want to violate, you know, your licensing. On top of that, just for most people to know, your malpractice typically tracks with licensing. So if you're licensed and there's agreements, your malpractice will cover you if there is a problem. If there isn't agreements with other states and you're practicing and out of the goodness of your heart or doing virtual visits with people, especially when you've started treatment from another state, that may not be covered by licensure. And if it's not, that may put you at peril if, God forbid, there is a malpractice claim where that may not be covered because you're not covered by licensure. So I think you have to sort of be cognizant of that. The easiest way to default is in state, you're going to be fine in general. Mm-hmm. And across states, if there's reciprocity, you're typically fine.
So how do you really find out about that? That's something that I can't say I've given much thought to. I know it came up with my husband that he's been treating somebody for years from Connecticut, but the guy always comes to New York, so that's not a problem. Now he can't do that. And it turned out, apparently, we did have reciprocity. That wasn't an issue. But how does somebody find that out?
Yeah, the best is to talk to your state board of registration of medicine, and they have a lot of frequently asked questions, and most of them now have COVID FAQs. So you should go and speak with them. And also, this is great with state assemblies. So ACAPS assemblies are generally pretty much on top of that. So your local ACAP group, like our New England Consul, or, you know, I was just having a video conference with Kansas, the Kansas Consul of Child and Adolescent Psychopharm will certainly know Kansas and local areas. So I would encourage you to lean in and talk to your local ACAP group.
Okay. And so you sort of implied this, that the guidelines for the care of children have been relaxed some in terms of the monitoring and in terms of the licensure. So what things do we not have to worry so much about in terms of monitoring, A, and B, when you do monitor, how do you do that? How do you manage pulses, blood pressures, heights and weights are probably pretty easy to do. So are pulses, but anyway, how do you do that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And that's certainly making a lot of people nervous. You know, how do you treat? And against the dilemma that you're probably going to be leaning in and starting new meds or increasing meds in patients sometimes you may never have seen, et cetera. So number one is that standard of care really is defined by what the local standard of care is, which is often reflective of the national standard of care. And, you know, programs like the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the Psychopharmacology Committee, and Neurotherapeutics Division has made it really clear that, yes, you should be starting medicines when it's appropriate, and legitimate medicines, of course. And yes, you're not going to be able to monitor in the same way that you did before. And yes, it's okay to do that. So sort of at a national level, we have leaned in to say, yes, it's okay to start and treat people without the same sort of monitoring or following the guidelines set by ACAP and AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics. Having said that, how do you do that? You have to use a lot of common sense on this. So if you're going to start a medicine that requires monitoring, You're going to have to say to parents and talk to them about, you're not going to be monitoring. We're going to have to watch really carefully. And the in-person visits, you're going to have to really figure out how do you do that virtually. So if you have somebody you're worried about, let's say, extrapyramidal side effects, if you have somebody you're worried about tardive dyskinesia, you're going to have to explain what that looks like. But also, if you have video capability, to take a look at it using videos, and that seems to work reasonably well. If you have individuals who are starting medicines for the SGAs, you're not going to be able to get baseline labs. If there's any labs previously, great. If not, then you're just going to need to follow up, and then you're going to use common sense on that one. You're going to be watching for weight. You're going to be looking for the clinical symptoms of diabetes, and you're going to have to inform people and be asking about that. So you're going to have to use sort of the old-fashioned practitioner approach to where we didn't have so much monitoring available, to do it through clinical symptoms. If you're starting medicines that might have problems with hepatitides, let's say you're starting atomoxetine and you want to warn people about that, rather than doing liver function tests, which, by the way, we don't do anyway, but some people do, you know, warn people about if the kid's urine turns to Coca-Cola, that's a pretty good indication that there's hepatic dysfunction and you're going to have to jump on that before it becomes an issue. So no, we're not bringing people in and monitoring them. We're not doing the routine fasting, you know, fasting bloods. We think certainly we can get through COVID without that. If I think you're using trickier meds, for example, if you're using the mood stabilizers, and I, in the last couple of weeks, have de novo started lithium as well as carbamazepine on patients. Again, we're going without baseline labs, but, you know, I'm going to keep the medicine subtherapeutic. You know, we all know kind of where therapeutic dosing is, and we're going to try to get away with subtherapeutic dosing with the understanding that we may have slow metabolizers or people may develop more toxicity, particularly as we get to more therapeutic levels. And I'm going to probably ride it out until I can get blood levels. So rather than using higher dose lithium, I use what I call mini dose lithium, you know, 150 twice a day in a younger kid and maybe 300 milligrams twice a day in an older kid or a college student. And I'm going to see how well that works before I start ramping the doses up. So these are sort of tricks that we're all using right now to manage individuals, trying to stay on the safe side, but at the other side of it, trying to appropriately treat psychopathology, which we know is going to be a major concern now moving forward.
One of the things that I've done is if there's something that a parent is concerned about, like George has developed this funny movement, I'll say, take a video and send it to me. Mm-hmm. So there are things like that that you can do. People can be taught to take their, you know, their own pulse rate. They can do, clearly they can do their own heights and weights. I think as we quote unquote open up, there are going to be the abilities to do blood draws. I had to get some, I have osteoporosis, and so every 6 months I have to get a vitamin D levels drawn. So I go to my appointment, and I felt like it was a clandestine meeting. It was like you stay in your car, you let them know you're there, they open the back door, you slide in, you get your blood drawn, and you scoot back out again. The only thing that got touched was my arm in terms of the venipuncture. It was kind of funny. But the point was, it got done. And so now, granted, I live out in Long Island, where it's not that crowded and so forth and so on. They make sure, obviously, that you're not running into anybody for the social distancing. But, I mean, clearly it can be done if it's something that's really concerning. I think that measuring people's waist circumferences and you know, those kinds of things, if people are concerned about it, you can do it. Other than clozapine, and was there some discussion about clozapine that we had in the psychopharm meeting about things that were relaxed on that were worth mentioning?
There are, and I wish I could tell you the details, but what I would say is, and probably everybody who is taking care of kids or adults on clozapine know those relaxations, but there definitely have been guideline changes for monitoring clozapine, especially in people who have been stable for a period of time. That's the group that has had the biggest relaxation. New starts are still requiring pretty close observation, but it's the people who have been stable and those have changed. And I wish I could tell you the specifics, but I just don't have those at my fingertips.
So are there any things that you would like to mention that I haven't asked you about in the final minutes of this discussion?
Yeah, so I would say that the things I would say is that you should continue your practice. You're going to need to really lean in. I think we're going to have to, we've relaxed the monitoring requirements. I think we're going to all, at the end of this, start to say telehealth has some real advantages. And I know that you've had chats previously about telehealth, and that's great. But I think we know from NIH studies that they work. And I think in real life, they work really well. And I think that it's been a huge win. I think patients like it. Our practitioners like it. It ultimately is one way to keep costs down and increase access. And I think that this is here to stay, to help figure out ways to keep kids, especially when you're in expensive hospital settings outside of the hospitals, not for every visit, but for some of those visits. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really helpful. I also think that another lesson learned is, can we try to work with DEA, state licensing boards, et cetera, to have more uniform licensing and coverage with malpractice, et cetera, that really is reasonable. I don't want to put the genie back in the bottle on this one. I think there's been some relaxation that has worked really well. And my hope would be that we could work with legislators to try to continue this so that we can provide telehealth, something that we know for years it should be done, particularly for things like psychopharmacology and psychiatry, psychotherapy visits. So I leave it with, you know, I see this as a huge silver lining and a real advantage. And from a psychopharmacologic standpoint, we think you can do an awful lot of really good things with telehealth.
Yeah, I think our responsibility in this naturalistic experiment that's been foisted on us, I'm hoping that we are collecting data to be able to say what the advantages and disadvantages are, so that at the end of it, we can say these are the times when you can use virtual treatment or virtual evaluations. These are the circumstances in which it's less effective. These are the situations in which it's dangerous to use it. So, you know, it's like any kind of intervention. It's not a one size fits all. It's when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate. And it would be useful to get those guidelines. So thank you very much, Tim. As always, you're extremely informative and fun to talk to. And we appreciate hearing from you at Screenside Chats, and have a nice day.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAP's Screenside Chats.